This is the 12 Songs of Christmas. I'm Alex Rawls, and Christmas is coming. Today's episode is special for me because I've been trying to get the Indigo Girls on the podcast for a few years now, but their schedules have been so structured that we couldn't make it work until this fall. In the spring, I interviewed Amy Ray for My Spilt Milk, my music blog, and I'll post a link to that story in the show notes. She was coming to New Orleans to play with her own band, and while talking, we connected over our shared love of the Roaches. I sent her a link to my episode of 12 Songs with Terry Roach from last season, which you should check out if you haven't, and again, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And I guess that did the trick, because when I next asked about getting on their schedule, we figured it out. I'm sure part of the issue was that the Indigo Girls' Christmas album was hardly a new release. They put out Holly Happy Days in 2010, but I was fascinated by it because it seemed like a standalone album in their catalog in the way many Christmas albums do, but it also seemed very them in its DIY spirit, its enacted sense of community, its willingness to go its own way, and its obvious roots in Amy Ray and Emmy Salyer's experiences. We'll get to that in a minute, but first, I want to let you know that this year's 12 Songs of Christmas mixtape is available now free to listeners. I've been listening to it since Black Friday, and I'm very entertained by it, as artists celebrate the holiday in jazz, pop, bounce, punk, funk, and a host of other styles. You'll recognize some of the songs from this season and last season on 12 Songs, and some that I'm very happy to find. K-Bond's Christmas by what looks like Sion O'Hagan on the liner notes is actually Sean O'Hagan from the High Llamas and Stereolab. And since I love his work, I was happy to find this on a Japanese Christmas compilation. I was also pleased to discover by dumb luck Teenage Christmas by Nikki Sudden and Dave Cusworth, who recorded in the 90s as the Jacobites. It never occurred to me that an act that largely found its musical blueprint and the New York Dolls guitarist Johnny Thunders would have a Christmas song, much less a fun, up-tempo one. There's a lot of cool stuff in here, including producer Americo Gazaway's remix of Busta Rhymes' Hoo Ha as a Christmas song, and he makes it make sense. If you want this year's Christmas mix, email me at alex@myspiltmilk.com, and I'll fire it over. You don't want to shop without it. Let's now get to the Indigo Girls, who were in their respective homes when we talked. To start, let's begin with one of their most beloved songs, Closer to Fine, which has enjoyed renewed attention and exposure to another generation through its use in Greta Gerwig's film Barbie. We'll hear Closer to Fine, then be back on the other side with the Indigo Girls on 12 Songs.
I'm trying to tell you something about my life. Maybe give me insight between black and white. And the best thing you ever done for me is to help me take my life less seriously. It's only life after all. Yeah. Well, darkness has a hunger.
What Christmas music did you connect with? Growing up?
Well, I grew up going to church with my family, and most of the Christmas music that I connected with were hymns in church. And so we would have hymn sings and things like that. So very many of the hymns that might be in the Methodist hymnal were Christmas music that I related to a lot. And then, of course, you know, we had like the prerequisite. I think even at my young age, there were Christmas specials, maybe a Peanuts Christmas special or things like that, where I enjoyed that Christmas music. When I was young, we weren't completely, there wasn't an onslaught of Christmas music everywhere, like on all the waves and in all the malls and stuff like that. It was, so it didn't get to the point where Christmas music could become quite irritating if it was piped in everywhere. But so Christmas music was really, really important for me growing up. And now it's less about commercialized Christmas music and more about the hymns that remind me of the stories of Christmas and time with my family.
Sure. I'm going to come back to some of that. But Amy, do you have an answer?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up also in the Methodist Church. And so the hymns were the first things, you know, Oh Holy Night, In the Bleak Midwinter. I remember I really loved Go Tell It on the Mountain because it was like a different kind of hymn, you know, and like the traditional hymns that I really enjoyed singing. One of them, God Rest You Merry Gentlemen, I like the melody a lot. And of course I was in the church choir, so that was super fun. And we always went to the big services all during, you know, the season, and well, all the time. I went to church all the time, but during Christmas season, it was really fun because the Hallelujah Chorus and all the great things that would happen. And like the bell songs, we had like a bell choir and all that. So I remember all that really, I loved that so much. And then my family, Emily's family might've done this too, but we did the neighborhood caroling, and would go down through the neighborhood with, another group of people from Shamrock, from the high school we went to, would gather and we would go sing at everybody's door. My whole family and then a few other families would join and whoever was around, you know, we did that in the neighborhood. So, and then we had a tradition to watch the Charlie Brown Christmas every year. And I still do that with my kid. We do the Halloween, the Thanksgiving, the Christmas, Charlie Brown shows. And so, you know, Hark the Herald Angels Sing has a very special place because of the Charlie Brown Christmas and the way they sing it. And I have this little Hallmark Charlie Brown Christmas like statue that my dad gave me that he's passed now, and it's like precious. I keep gluing it back together and it goes Hark the Herald Angels Sing. So it's like one of the main things that we put out at Christmas, you know, that reminds me of my dad. And we still do caroling around the, I have like my mom gets neighborhood people to come over and we do one night of just standing around the piano while my sister plays and all sing Christmas carols. And then we do that at my house now too, although my piano is out of tune compared to my mom's, but it's a thing, you know, I don't like to start listening to them until after Thanksgiving. That's kind of my rule.
Sure. Understandable.
My partner Gary and our kid like to start listening to them in October, so right. I've told them they're not allowed till after Thanksgiving because that's like when you really love them, you know, when it's getting cold outside and all that, you know.
You just Amy, you just mentioned some I was going to ask you about, because I have to say I have never got In the Bleak Midwinter, maybe because I find it bleak. I find that melody hard to hang on to. Can you give me, either as a singer or from your past, why that song resonates for you?
Well, I think Emily and I both love that song because it's kind of dark.
It was my mom's favorite Christmas hymn, actually, too. So.
And my mom's, too. And my sister, Susan, is a much better singer than I. And she sings in a more of a choir, you know, soprano voice. And the first time I heard that song was her singing it as a solo in church or something when she was, you know, in college or whatever. And I don't think I had heard it before in the same light. So I don't know. It's kind of more of this world, I think, in a way. And it's metaphorical, I guess, and kind of minor. It is a hard melody to hang on to in some ways. I was listening to our version of it and there's a few moments where the harmony, I was like, that doesn't really work. Why did we do that kind of thing, you know? Because the melody's so weird, you know? And you can make it really Baroque sounding in a way that is cool, but also could be off-putting if you want to just jingle the bells, you know?
In the bleak midwinter, frosty wind made moan, earth stood hard as iron, water like a stone. Snow had fallen, snow on snow, snow on snow.
was my mom's favorite Christmas hymn, so it's always been important to me. She's passed on about 13 years now, I guess, and it always brings her back to me. When we sing it and to record it, for me and Amy to record it, was like a way to sort of encode that memory and the power of that song. So there was that element of it for me. And that's the thing about a lot of Christmas music, is that there's very, unless you go to church or synagogue or whatever, temple, mosque, whatever your faith is, if you go, or if you have organized community gatherings, there's not a lot of ritual, especially seasonal ritual. And so that's something that's very, very important to me about Christmas music, is the stories and the seasons. And you sort of, you know, a season is coming, just like, you know, spring, summer, fall, winter. But these are more, if they're tied to sacred importance in your life, they become an important, like, human experience. For me, they have. So that, like, encoding that song and thinking about my mom, and also what Amy said, it's of the world. I mean, if you think about, rather than jingling the bells, if you think about the brutality of giving birth in a manger, whatever you believe or don't believe,
sure,
it's cold as hell. And it's, you know, the hay is sticky and prickly, and it's, there's a lot of unrest about it. And I think the fact that it's in a minor key, it's something that's really important to reflect what might have been a very brutal night, and you know, juxtaposed with the hope that it was bringing with the star and the magi and all of that stuff. So it's really, really got a lot of complexity to it that I appreciate. I find the melody really interesting, maybe not so sing-along-y, but quite a strong melody, if it's unusual. And so there's many, many things to that hymn that I can really sink my teeth into.
Oh, that's great. You know, one thing I've been thinking about listening to both of you that I connect to is I also run a caroling, though we actually have what I always called a caroling pub crawl, where we basically meet at a restaurant and then we essentially walk into bars and restaurants, any store that's open, you know, nail parlors, and sing to whoever's inside. And it's far more about, it's kind of a punk rock activity. I carry a tune like a bucket. And so it's far more about the spirit and the community. It's fun to both have people with me to sing and to go to people who, and have them have a moment of being around saying, this is only happens in New Orleans. And
I know, I was going to say, that sounds so New Orleans.
I know, man. It used to be such a, I don't know if people do it as much anymore in just normal suburban life, but because it's so, I think, strange to think of knocking on someone's door that you don't know if they're singing. But like, to me, it was, you know, it wasn't risky behavior or anything or like revolutionary back then, but it would be very punk rock just to go in and sing in a business and, you know, just impromptu performance art is what it really is.
What I was thinking about though was as time has passed, what's become really important to me about Christmas and about Christmas music is the way that it's tied to community.
Yeah.
That we've got 10 to 15 people who will always be there for caroling if they can be. And then we have another, usually another 5 or 10 who will or won't show. And I think now about community of people who I've developed, who I've run into by doing this podcast and who are now a part of that community, and different activities that I do over the course of the Christmas season. I realize that what matters most to me about Christmas is that sense of people coming together and that, you know, these days rare moment of shared purpose. And it seems like even when I look at your record and the number of musical guests you had on it, that you basically, whether you were thinking about it, it seemed like you like created or brought your community with you to go actually make a Christmas album.
I mean, we do that generally in our music. Like, that's just kind of our MO. And probably for us, music started as a community activity because of church and high school choir and our families being musical. And, you know, everything was always group, 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 you know. And I guess Christmas, you know, it's just kind of part of that DNA if you think about it, like the way that you gather and stuff. So the association, I mean, it totally makes sense to me. I've never thought about it in the long, in like the sort of breadth of how we approach everything, which is just always community-based. And of course, the every record we make, we try to bring in a bunch of people because we enjoy it that way, you know. But yeah, definitely this one, you know, I mean, I guess when you think we're going to make a holiday record, it's like the first thing you think of is who else is going to want to sing on it? Because music like that is, yeah, it's not meant to be like an individual pursuit, really. I mean, I guess some people walk around their house singing songs, Christmas songs by themselves during Christmas season, but it's not as fun as if it doesn't really mean as much if you're just doing it alone to me.
Yeah.
It's all about the gathering, you know, that's what makes it enjoyable. I mean, honestly.
Sure. This record struck me as having a stronger bluegrass element than some of your, there's bluegrass in all of your stuff, but it seemed like a very strongly sort of bluegrass forward arrangements. Was that a deliberate, and if so, why?
I think it wasn't it a function of who the guests were, Emily. I think that's
yeah. I don't think we said we're going to make a bluegrass Christmas album or holiday album. Actually, there's a couple of you know, but and then Luke Bula, who I think probably played on almost every song, incredible fiddle player, just one of the best there is,
and flat picker.
And flat picker. So everything that he played on obviously is going to lend that feeling to it. And the song that Amy wrote for the album is very bluegrass or of the mountains, of the hills vibe. And it's also, it's folk. The album is folk music, folky. And that lends itself very easily to a bluegrass approach. And it's kind of our neck of the woods. And it just seemed like a very, very musically a fun way to bring in these people, and then it sort of became what it was.
Allison Brown
playing banjo, just everybody, if you look at the list, and
Brandy sang on this, right?
Brandy Carlisle.
Yeah.
And Julie Wolf was involved, and she'd played with us. She's not a bluegrass musician, but so we didn't come in like with stringent ideas to make it bluegrass, and then it's got a little, like, it's flavored with some other things, like my dad played piano on it, and we did a hymn that he showed to me earlier on that both Amy and I loved. So there's a little bit of other things. And then Janice Ian came and sang on the Hanukkah song. And but it does have the bluegrass at its center, is the bluegrass flavor for sure.
Why did you decide to do a Christmas or a holiday record in the first place?
Well, our manager. Done one.
Sorry, Amy, go ahead.
Was it our manager?
I mean, I think we had never done one.
That's true. But Russell, our manager, he's a freak about Christmas music. Every year he makes like these huge mix. He's made so many Christmas mixtapes, and he gives them to all his friends. It's like legendary. You know, you guys should do a podcast together. You should interview him because he knows all the weird underground stuff, you know, like you. So Russell was really into it. And I think, I don't know, it might have even been his idea, Emily.
I can't remember whether it was. He was very enthusiastic about it. But in the end, like Amy and I don't do anything we don't feel comfortable doing or want to do. So I think it must have been like a collaborative excitement about making a holiday record. And then we knew that we wanted to write an original song, and we knew that we wanted to make it, you know, as inclusive as possible. I mean, it's obviously largely Christmas music, but it is a holiday season. We're always mindful of showing respect for all different kinds of faiths and celebrations during that particular season.
I'm going to come back to that in a moment, but you mentioned writing. Tell me about the challenges of writing a holiday song.
It's been, I mean, there's so many, it's, the classics are the classics, you know, and you can't, it's just not, it's just rare to find a newer holiday song that's classic, you know, George Michael.
Yeah.
You know, maybe, I think. So for me, but I had, you know, I had some, you know, I had been thinking about it for a while and had written a bunch of different things in my lyric journal and stuff. So for me, it was a personal pursuit of like capturing kind of two different sides of like what I think about during Christmas. So it wasn't like, I'm going to write this classic Christmas song. It was more like, what is this moment for me traditionally, you know? And so like the song, The Wonder Song, was kind of about this kind of Walton's like myth that I grew up with, that the animals talk after midnight. And, you know, when I moved up to the woods, I would always take a walk on Christmas Eve down to the river and sit for a while and see if it would show if it was true, you know, because there's a wonder of being a child that you. And so I started thinking about all the rituals that are more nature oriented, you know, that I really get into about Christmas and the Christmas trees and, you know, just the kind of the more pagan side of things too. And then I wrote a song, Mistletoe, that I think was more of a love song, you know, for somebody, you know, couched in the holiday, you know, garb. So it was just for me like a fun songwriting thematic, but I had no, I mean, to me, the classics are the classics. I don't know how you would ever, yeah. It's, they're just, they're, the great songs are just so amazing. So I don't even try to get into that territory, but it's fun to write something that's just about the time, I guess, for me.
Christmas, my love, gave me a stocking, sewn of sackcloth, hung on a nail. The simplest gift, warm by the fire, vessel of kindness, peace prevails. Will my silver, will my love fill it with gold? Will my love just fill it?
Emily, you were we have to ask you about writing your Christmas song or your holiday song.
Well, it was definitely a challenging thought. As I wrote the song, I found it less challenging than I anticipated it. I found a good chord progression. I think I wrote it on a classical guitar. I forget whether we recorded it on that, but I wrote it on that. And so there were some musical elements, the chord progression and the guitar that sort of like were propelling. And also I knew that I wanted to write a song kind of like, what are the ways that different people celebrate their holidays? So I definitely wanted it to be an inclusive song in terms of that. And then I just started thinking about images, or some beat on a drum and some light a candle and some do this and some do that. And so in terms of finding instances of how different people celebrate different holidays, that came fairly easily. So, and it's a little bit of a pop song feeling. In no way does it have any sort of traditional vibe. And I don't think I concern myself with that at all. You know, there are some songs on that album, like that Beth Nielsen Chapman song, "There's Still My Joy." I mean, to me, that could be a classic. It's just a matter of all the other classic Christmas songs have been sung and ingrained in our psyches, our memories, our bodies for years. And I mean, who knows how many years, decades, millennium, whatever it is.
Right.
But I knew that the song that I was going to write was not like that. I felt like it was cool that Amy and I were going to just write our own songs, which is, again, something just like doing a holiday album. We hadn't written a holiday song before.
Sure.
So I thought it was a fun challenge. I don't remember feeling any like trepidation about writing it. And I knew for sure at the outset that I wanted it to be sort of all inclusive.
Along those lines, you recorded, is it Woody Guthrie's Happy Joyous Hanukkah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell me the story of that, of digging it up and of recording it.
Did Janice Ian bring, no, how did we?
No, she sang on it but kind of directed it in a way. I remember her in the studio.
How we found that song.
You know, Peter Collins may have dug that one up. We went looking for a Hanukkah song, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, I think that is what we did. We looked for him and...
And that was such a great one because it has all those different verses. Yeah. So in terms of putting it together in the studio, it's so fun. You know, it's like a candy store. Well, Janice could sing this and Amy can sing this one. And then Amy and Janice and I can sing this one. And then we can do this one, you know. And it was just it was such a cornucopia of joy arranging that song. I remember that.
Oh, that's great.
But you know, I couldn't testify to how exactly we found it. Except that we were hunting for one, so we landed on it.
How many nights for Hanukkah? Happy, joyous Hanukkah. Nights and days, days and nights. Happy, joyous Hanukkah. Eight of the nights of Hanukkah. Happy, joyous Hanukkah. Eight of the days and eight of the nights. Happy, joyous Hanukkah.
It's a cool folk song because it's got a lot of things, you know. I love folk songs where everybody can take a verse.
Right.
You
know? Yeah.
And it tells the stories, you know, the Maccabees, yeah, and the light not going out and all, yeah, the, you know, of the Jewish tradition. I think, you know, I've got many, many close Jewish friends and they do talk about feeling left out in some ways, or there are business meetings that carry on Hanukkah and, you know, and just ways that their holidays are not celebrated broadly, which is, you know, you can see why that happens, but it felt really good to include a romp that told all the story, in particular of the Jewish faith, for that song. So that was cool.
Yeah. At the point when you recorded Holly Happy Days, you were 25 or so years into your career. What role did that play in the decision to do it?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, I think part of it was that, you know, I can't remember completely what the conversation was, but I'm sure, you know, some of it was like, well, here's something we haven't done. <You know? laughs> But also at that point, we knew a lot of musicians that we really liked. You know, we had access to a lot of cool singers and players and stuff like that. So the thought of it was fun because we, over that amount of time, you know, had met and been fans of so many different songwriters and players and singers and all that. So I think it also earlier in our career, it might not have seemed as fun maybe because we might not have immediately thought of all the people that we want to bring into that project. Although it probably would have been just a different set of people, but you know, I think that's part of it. And just knowing that we can, you know, if we can just take the time out to do that and it's not going to be, it didn't feel like the stakes were that high, I guess, in some ways too, you know, you're having fun. You do it cause it's fun. And you know, it's not like this has to be a big hit record or something. Just have to have fun with it. I mean, that's,
and we did end up doing a live performance. You remember, Amy?
Yeah.
And that was so fun, but it was never going to be, we're going to do this every year and do Holly Happy Days every year. Right. It was just kind of like, we're doing this now and this is joyful. And I think that's the way we looked at the whole project.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons I asked was kind of, I think Amy kind of addressed it, was I wondered if there is a sort of a, you know, that kind of a, I don't say confidence, but you know, you've earned the place at this point. You're past the point where your career, you feel like your career rises or falls on a record. And so if you felt like this was the time to do this one, it's not like it was all going to come apart or people were going to decide what was I thinking and back away, that you'd got to a place where this wasn't going to be a make or break record for your career.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I don't know why I remember this. Amy says, never read any reviews or anything, but I can't help it. Sometimes that just my eyes go to them. And just speaking to all that, because I remember when I don't know if it was Apple Music or whatever, they do, your album pops up and then there's a little bit of a blurb and then you can read some comments about it. And one person about Holly Happy Days said, just no.
Wow.
It made me laugh because it's like, well, there were, for some people, we could never do anything right, which is, you know, I guess the laughs on them now because we're really, really happy with the way everything has gone. But the idea of us doing a Christmas album is just like, to some people, like, oh my goodness, no. But so we didn't care. We didn't think about any stakes. As Amy said, there weren't any stakes. And we've just spent a long time just doing what we want to do creatively at the time that we want to do it. And there are lots of examples of that either before or after Holly Happy Days, where we did the same thing.
Do you remember a point when you realized it kind of doesn't matter, as long as we're making ourselves happy, this is going to work out? About your music, the musical career, not just the album.
Yeah, I figured that's, I don't know. I mean, we always, you know, we sort of operated the same our whole career. So I don't think we ever said, well, we've made it, so now we can relax. I think it's more about, like, for us, it has to have kind of some kind of growth element, or you're learning something, or you're having fun. Something that is a catalyst for other things in your life has to be happening while you're doing whatever it is you're doing in this career for us. And we sort of always had that standard. And it wasn't really based on, I mean, of course, the stakes feel higher the first record you make with a record company. Actually, the second record probably feels higher. Nah. But, you know, but it's kind of the same every record for us. We're always like, what can we learn from this? What can we do? How can we do our best? So I don't think, I mean, for me personally, there wasn't like a moment when I went, yeah, we can rest easy now, you know, because we've always sort of been on the edge of our seats a little bit, you know. Been like solidified in a way that's like, you know, their standard, you know, like a classic band or something like that. In a way, we've always kind of fought for our place in some, you know, in certain ways. You know, this record, I think we definitely had, yeah, the space to make it and could, and part of it's because we weren't like on a label necessarily either, which was a big part of it. So you really just had your space to make it, you know, but it still was important for us to do good. I mean, I listen to it now and I definitely hear things where I'm like, oh God, I wish I had sung that better or did that better. I'm better now. I wish we could do it again. I wish we could change that. Cause I think on this record, particularly for me, there was a certain amount of inexperience at this kind of project that I can hear now.
Oh, wow.
That I couldn't hear while I was doing it, you know? And so there's always things like that, but it's a good thing cause you learn from it, you know, and it humbles you and all that. But I don't know. I don't know if Emily feels like there was a moment where she could rest. Maybe now. I don't know.
I mean, it is different whether you're signed to a major label and you're very early in your career and they're thinking about things in terms of business. And, you know, although we had a very good relationship with Epic Records for the length of that run. But once we were free to do our own thing, like Amy said, we were never frivolous about the decision to record albums. And, you know, we did some what might be considered to be offbeat stuff, like a live album and a double live album with the University of Colorado Symphony, and just things that may not be like a typical trajectory of a release of albums and stuff. But there are, the whole way along, I have cringed at certain points on albums. Like, I would never look at an album and go, oh, we did this exactly how I would do it again if we were to do it today. And there are like when you start recording albums when you're as young as Amy and I were, I mean, there are a lot of lyrics that, my gosh, I wish I had not written the lyric that way. And I think it could be, the same could be true maybe for an arrangement or anything on the Holiday album. But I also have some peace with that because it was of its time. It was of our experience. It was of our voice and our capacities and our joy and all that stuff. So I'm able to pretty much let that go. And the only time it's like twings is when I sing a song now that I know as that lyric goes by, I wish I'd written it differently. But, you know, it's... It is not a world-changing thing. It's just a personal, artistic thing that you always hope you can not look back and cringe at your work.
Yeah. Have there been any lines that you, in songs you have to keep singing or you feel like you need to keep singing them, that you've tweaked and realized, I just can't keep singing that line anymore?
Yeah, I have. I mean, in the song Hammer and a Nail, I got that. It was like I was Yogi Berra or something. I got that line wrong about wet behind the ears or green or whatever. I just got the whole line wrong. And at one point, I just couldn't sing it like that anymore. So I just altered it to make it fit, the way that it was supposed to be said. And now we sing it like that.
Oh, that's great.
But other lines go by that I would not tell you what they are, because there's some of the songs that are very close to some of the fans, and just because of the they express that to us, and I wouldn't change their experience of it or even like bring the shame upon myself as a bad writer of that line, you know. So just let it go. But so I had to change that. I couldn't stand it anymore.
So I gotta say, one of my favorite songs on the album is your version of It Really Is a Wonderful Life. And like the first version I heard of that was by Mindy Smith. And it was while preparing for this that I realized it was actually written by Shelley Wright. How did you come across that?
Through Shelley Wright.
Oh, okay. Right?
Yeah.
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 Because we knew her.
Oh, okay.
That's and then we heard Mindy's version of it.
I can't speak for Amy necessarily, but well, that was huge. Mindy Smith. I remember discovering her and going, oh my goodness, who is this writer and her voice? And our paths crossed some, not a lot. So she really, you know, delivered that song in a way that was just so beautiful. Cause you know, there's a gazillion songs to choose and we chose really carefully, but it was also nice to have a song that Shelley wrote because, you know, now she's under the same management that we are and she's a queer artist and there's just lots that felt good about singing one of her songs.
You know,
yeah, it's a great, and that's a pretty classic sounding song to me.
Yeah.
You know?
The snow has fallen like it does every year. The tree I know so well is aglow. And folks are filled up with the usual holiday cheer. Some mistletoe. Oh, but this year's different for you and
is there a song that you're proud of on the record that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, we covered Peace Child, which I, you know, when I go back and listen to it, I think that's one of the best cuts on the record and the most interesting and relevant. And, you know, it's religious, but it's also secular, and that's a cool cross, you know, a crossing of like cross-pollination of things, I think. And yeah, so because to me, you know, whether or not you believe in the literal stories of Christmas, you know, in the gospel and everything in the New Testament, there's, if it's part of your cosmos, the stories are very important to your rituals and they're metaphorical for your life and they can be applied to your life now, you know? And so that song fulfills that promise in a way. So I just, and it's special because Emily's dad was on it, but I think also it's just a special song. So for me, that one stands out a lot.
That's great.
I agree with Amy that that one stands out for me. It was written by two women, contemporary hymn writers. That's unusual when you consider the canon of hymns that have been written. And as Amy mentioned, my dad, you know, I remember when my dad was in the studio, like he doesn't have a lot of experience in recording studios like we've been in. And I wondered, like, is dad going to be able to pull this off? And I remember he played it so beautifully. And also that song is rooted, whether or not you are of a Christian faith, that song is about hope in the times of war and sorrow. And so it's just applicable to kind of the human experience in many ways. And it's just so beautiful. And it was a simple arrangement. And so that one really stands out. But to be honest with you, I love that album. I love that album. Like, I really do. I mean, sometimes like we'll put it on in our house when we're listening to a bunch of different holiday music. And I just like usually we don't play Indigo Girls music in our house. Like, I can't stand it. But we play that album in the season. I'm like, I really like this album because so many of the songs are classic, but there's songs that aren't classic. And then everything we've talked about with all the people who played on it. So when you have your friends playing on your albums, they become forever a part of, it's not just the parts that were played or sung. It's those people that you love that are on them, you know, and there'll be a day when some of them or all of us will not be around anymore, but there we are in that music. And I find that profound during a season of, you know, reverence and joy. So I love that album, but that is one of the songs that stands out for me.
Peace tried in the sleep of the night, in the dark before light. You come in the silence of stars, in the violence of
thanks to Amy Ray and Emmy Salyers for the time and the talk. The Indigo Girls remain road warriors and still have a handful of December dates left this year, and they'll resume touring in March. You can go to Indigo Girls to see when they're coming to your town. Thanks for listening, and if you like what you heard, tell your friends. We've had good conversations this season on 12 Songs, and I'd love for more people to know about them. If you're an Apple person and feel like leaving a review, that would be awesome. Thank you. If you're an Indigo Girls fan and new to the podcast, I hope you'll check out some of the other episodes. In this episode, we talked about It Really Is a Wonderful Life, the song written by Shelley Wright that the Indigo Girls perform on Holly Happy Days. I mentioned that the first version of the song I heard was by Mindy Smith, and let's finish with that. From her excellent Christmas album, My Holiday, this is It Really Is a Wonderful Life. Talk to you next week.
Oh, but this year is different for you and me.